else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring... He's pointing down over
yes,
there.
Yes, I was trying to make the volume go down. We were reading out on there. Yes, so starring, go ahead. Let's start over.
I totally lost my rhythm here.
Okay, all right. Do you want to start the music again?
Okay.
Okay.
Let's start the music again. Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it's exciting because we realize how often and how likely it is that we're going to screw things up and embarrass ourselves and make complete fools out of ourselves.
Yes.
And actually, not make complete fools out of
just
ourselves.
Show the complete fool that
yes,
we are.
Yes, actually show the fools that we are.
That's a different story than making the fool, because that's already happened.
Yes.
We're already made fools of.
Yes, I am, well, sort of. We are fools.
Yes.
But I don't want to
very there's a clearly, trademark on that.
Yes,
for
so
some
we're not motley fools.
No.
We're ear motley fools. Unmotley? What's the opposite of a motley? Consistent fool.
Monochrome?
I don't know. Anyway.
Motley is lots of colors.
Is
so.
It? No, I don't think it is. I think motley, I don't know what motley is.
Motley is what fools wear, which is lots of colors.
So we're conventional fools.
Right. Well, monochrome fools, so that we don't, except that I'm wearing plaid. You're wearing plaid today as well. You're going to confuse everyone.
I'm confusing myself.
People can tell us apart on the radio by me wearing plaid and you wearing plain, and now you've messed that up. Just in case you're having trouble differentiating between our voices, my father, Jeff, has a white beard, and I have a darker beard. There's some gray in it, but that should help you differentiate between them. This is
right.
Jake speaking. So.
Right. So when you listen to us by listening to the color of our beards, you should be able to tell which
absolutely.
Of us is really old and which of us is...
That's kind of the cheat sheet for those of you out there in radio land. So you will know us apart if you need to.
Yes. And we both bald, and we look a little bit like the Smith Brothers cough drop. Anybody who remembers that.
I have seen a lot of cough drops, and I'm not sure that I...
The advertisement, actually, the label that was on the Smith Brothers cough drop bottle, but I don't, or can. And, but the problem is that all these things that I take for granted that people know what are, there's a growing number of people who don't know what are.
Yeah, you used to tell me how much toothpaste to put on my toothbrush when I was young.
Really?
And you would say, a little dab will do you. And I had no idea what you were talking about. Now I know
but
it's hair cream. But
real cream,
you know.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for being so clear. And as we are being right now and differentiating between the two of us.
Right,
but
right.
We've got a disclosure to give.
It's a boundaries sort of thing. Yes, a disclosure. The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this radio program. However, it is irretrievably interactive and intertwined as well as affiliated with an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, also called, not coincidentally, the Personal Wealth Coach, which has a couple of principles there, and there's a couple of principles here. And if you go see any of those principles, you've been called to the principal's office, so obviously something's messed up.
Stop talking in class. If you're going to bring snacks, bring enough for everyone.
And the Personal Wealth Coach is registered with the, but not necessarily approved of, you got to say that, by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. That's our regulator.
Mm-hmm.
So if we say something that you think is completely out to lunch with regard to investments.
Yes.
False, misleading, deceptive.
Any of that good stuff or bad stuff.
Fundamentally evil.
You should report us.
Yes, you should report us to the SEC.
Yes.
Immediately, if not sooner. Except not today, because they're closed on Saturdays.
Right. You have to wait till Monday.
Yes, unlike the police department.
Well, it's not like you have a lot of emergency fraud happening right now. Mm-hmm. So they're allowed to take the weekends off.
Well, I noticed that there was a gentleman, and that's a bit of a stretch, in New York this week who was convicted of securities fraud.
But not on a weekend.
No. And this is the thing I found fascinating. The guy had absolutely no credentials, no registrations, no licenses. He was a waiter. Okay?
At a restaurant.
At a restaurant.
Not somebody that just loiters.
And convinced he convinced over 200 people to give him $800,000
each or
total.
Okay.
To invest in his hedge fund.
Okay.
That's a heck of a tip.
Well, let's kind of take a step back. Hedge funds generally only allow you to invest per person close to $800,000.
Well, no, I mean, what he said is that he has – no, people don't believe that. That's the problem. And by the way, you can.
Complete the sentence.
Well, okay. What happened is the guy was spending it on mostly himself. Very little of it ever got invested in any form or fashion. And he lost that.
He was hedging his bets.
Boy, did he ever. He spent it on himself. I mean, basically, he was running a Ponzi scheme, except that he wasn't even bothering to send out statements.
He was just saying, yeah, thank you very much. I'm going to go buy a nice meal.
And when people would call him, he would say, you know, he was claiming 30 to 40% gains per year.
So basically, all he said, when people called up, and he would say, how much did you give me? I gave you $2,000. Well, now you have three.
Actually, he wasn't even doing that. He was saying, you got about a 30% gain in your account.
So he didn't even know how much they gave. Wow.
He was running this out of an apartment, in the bedroom of his apartment. He wasn't even keeping records on it. He was just, they give him the money, and he was spending the money. But the point is, this went on for several years he sent an email out that was actually intended to go to one person and inadvertently sent it to all of the people who'd given him money.
Uh-oh.
And that triggered a series of people trying to reclaim their money. I don't know what was in the email, but it must have been something pretty bad. And he had stock responses when people would complain about wanting to get their money back, and it was almost all something to do with something negative. But the point, he basically browbeat them into continuing to give him more money. Pardon me, but this is one of those things.
So if you got 200 investors and you raised $800,000,
right,
that's an average of $4,000 per investor,
right,
which is not generally considered a lot of money in the investment world. But the $800,000 is considered a lot of money in the investment world.
Right.
So he was able, probably I haven't read the case, but it's probably dealing with some pretty unsophisticated people.
Yes, like most of the people who are listening to this radio show.
or most of the people that exist in the world.
Yeah, and the point is, there was a guy, and this was in the Wall Street Journal, and there's comments at the bottom of the article by people, and somebody said, is there some way that people could have checked on him?
Yes.
And I thought, well, okay.
You can go to the IARD website, FINRA's IARD website, and look them up.
Investment Advisory Registry
Depository, I think.
IARD, registration something. Depository, that's it. If you, it's www.iard.org?
I will tell you in just a minute.
Probably .com.
It is IARD.com.
That's
IARD.com. Investment Advisor Registration Depository.
Yes, and go to the IARD. If somebody says, hey, I'm going to give you lots of good advice on how to invest your money, or I want to invest your money for you, step one, go to IARD.com and input their name.
If they have had securities fraud in the past, it's going to pop up there.
Not necessarily.
In a lot of cases
it will. But at least what you find out is they've bothered to register either with their state or with the SEC as an investment advisor.
Right.
Which is the minimum requirement if they say, I want to manage your money for you.
Well, there's another scam, and this one's just popped up, and I've seen this one personally. I've talked to – it keeps popping up. It's more than one occasion. It's popped up now in the last 10 years, I've seen it three times. And the scam is that you should buy Iraqi dinar.
That's still popping up?
It's popped up again. And that, and here are the key factors of the scam. There is a date involved. And it's generally within 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, the U.S. government is going to step in and back up the Iraqi dinar. And it's going to cause the dinar to leap in value. And they're the only ones that know this date. And when you go online and you look for anything like this happening, you don't see any evidence. Mm-hmm. So these people have an inside scoop somehow with the United States government, State Department, or something.
It had to be the Treasury, yeah.
And they know that the U.S. government is going to do something it just never does.
Well, it's 2 weeks in the future.
Which is to step in and buy or back up somehow undisclosed, make the Iraqi dinar leap in value.
And in doing so, fund ISIS with billions of dollars.
Right. So let's take this apart. Who is the person that is selling the dinar? Well, it's generally an insurance agent or an accountant.
Are you serious?
Also been scammed.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
They are totally convinced, and a lot of times it's an architect or it's professional people. These are not dimwits that are being scammed by this. And they are generally extreme right-wing conservatives.
Ah, okay.
And they're under the impression that the U.S. government is about to give away all of the U.S. dollars to some foreign country. And so if they're going to do that, then they're going to be part of it. They're going to get as much as they can out of it because the government's doing something horrible. Here's the problem with it. The back end, where the dinar actually comes from that is being sold, is generally from ISIS, the Islamic State.
Right.
So the Islamic State has a bunch of dinar.
Lots of dinar.
Lots and lots and lots.
Warehouses of dinar.
And they take this stuff, and there is no foreign exchange market properly set up for selling dinar in the United States. There is one for buying it. So hold that in your mind for a second. So you can buy Iraqi dinar. It is likely that who you're buying from is not such a savory character.
Mm-hmm. He's not well-flavored?
Right. But you're now
He's unsavory.
Right. Now you've purchased the dinar.
It's kind of like...
And you say, whoa, I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't have done that. I'm going to get my money back. I'm going to take it to the foreign exchange market and sell it.
You can't.
You can't, because the dinar, Iraq, is a monitored currency. Their currency is monitored because the Islamic State has a bunch of it, and we're trying to limit their resources.
Actually, we started monitoring dinar sales well prior to ISIS, because servicemen were... and women, I suppose, were actually finding stashes of Iraqi dinars, bales of them, and packaging them up and getting them back to the United States with the intent of selling them and converting them into dollars and making a lot of money. And
that's
the United
illegal.
States government said, no.
You can't do that.
We really would rather you didn't. Steal money from Iraq and bring it here and then try to convert it to dollars.
Right. So there are multiple layers here. And those layers generally amount to a pretty sophisticated scam set up by ISIS to sell dinars to the people that hate them the most.
Right.
Which, if you think about...
That makes perfectly good sense, actually.
How happy it makes them to get money from people that they know hate them.
I have been approached by one very popular real estate, not even an agent, broker... with this deal where he was absolutely convinced that there was this big deal going to come down. It would be announced.
Right. Within a couple of days or 2 weeks. 2 weeks seems to be the furthest
out. He's going to be fabulously wealthy, and then he's going to come and see us and invest his money.
Yeah.
And this, the funny thing, I saw him again recently, and this is months after his initial taking me aside very quietly.
Right. Because he doesn't want everybody to know he's about to have a lot of money because his friends will want
handouts.
How'd
your big deal go? And this is the funny thing. This is months later. And he said, oh, it's still in the works. It's just had a delay. I hate to admit this, but my mother went through the same scam.
Yeah. Well, it's not dinars, but something similar.
Well, actually, it was a guy in Saudi Arabia who supposedly needed to get his money into the United States.
It's kind of the Nigerian general concept. Yeah.
And the funny thing is this deal where somebody, where there's some secret get-rich-quick scheme that only the insiders know about. And
for some reason, they shared it with you.
And you just need to give them a little money, and they will be more than happy to make you fabulously wealthy.
Some of the factors on any scam is one, you should be aware. First, one factor is that it's secret. Nobody else knows about this. Second factor, it's being shared with you by someone that you don't know very well, but that has a great deal of trust for you all of a sudden. And they believe that you're an important factor in getting this money over. And I had a tree trimmer tell me about the Nigerian general that was about to transfer him a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
He'd already sent the bank account information and so on. This was several years back. And I was saying, that's a scam. And he says, no, it's not a scam. I verified the person. I've done Google searches. And I know that this general actually exists. And I had to say, well, you don't know that the person you're talking to is that general. And even if it were, what you're talking about doing is illegal. So that's another piece of the scam.
If it is you look illegal,
up,
yeah.
Yeah, if you look up the law and you find that it's illegal, but it's not a big illegality, you're not actually hurting anyone, that's another factor of almost any scam. So it's a secret that is being shared to you by someone in the know, and it's slightly illegal. Not enough to be totally repugnant. But enough to be embarrassing to go and report to the police.
And the interesting thing is, not only are you going to lose your money, and you are going to lose your money, not only are you violating the law, you combine the two together, you're probably funding a terrorist organization who wants to destroy the United States.
And that's with the dinar, for sure.
But even the Nigerian thing.
The Nigerian thing, you're probably funding terrorism there, too.
Yeah.
If you're talking about a local scam where somebody's lost a ring and they offer a reward and then you give them some money or whatever and it turns out that they're...
I'm not any familiar with that one.
Oh, this is a very common one where it's generally done at gas stations. It's done at convenience stores. It's done at malls.
Right.
Big...
What is it?
Anything that is owner-operated where the person behind the cash register may have access to the money beyond just a normal employee relationship.
Right.
And what they do is there's generally two people involved in the scam. And you can do it with a violin, which, you know, a cheap violin or whatever. Somebody needs to go across the street and buy something, cash a check, whatever. Could they get a quick... loan. Let me leave you my violin or my ring, and I'm going to go get some money. I'll be right back. So that some people might think, well, that's the scam. Don't take the thing because they're not going to be back. That's not the scam. The next piece of the scam is a supposed stranger is wandering by right as this is happening and stops and says, "May I see the ring? May I see the violin? Whatever. Oh, this is beautiful. I am a antiquities dealer. This is a fill in the blank fancy name type of ring, and man, you know, this thing is so valuable. I would pay any auction house would pay huge amounts of money, fill in the lots of zeros for this particular thing. It's beautiful. Okay, I'm leaving now." Person comes back and says, "You know, I wasn't able to get as much money as I wanted. I can only pay for part of my meal, part of my gas, fill in the blank."
Mm-hmm.
The person behind the register says, "Well, I'll just buy this from you. I'll just buy the violin, the ring, whatever the piece of jewelry is. I'll buy it from you. It'll help you out." And so it's taking advantage of the person's own greed here.
Mm-hmm.
So they now feel like they have a secret. So again, that factor, when I say you got a secret that was shared to you by someone in the know, out of the blue, trusting you, it's slightly illegal. You know that you're about to defraud someone of their valuable piece of whatever property. So you offer them $150 for the ring or the violin, and they say, oh, I could never part with this. Oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. They may try to talk you up to 200. They may just accept the 150, and then they leave. And then you find out that the ring is made of brass and glass, or the violin doesn't even hold a tune. And someone could buy it for $25. The ring works better because you can buy those for $5 and sell them for $150. And in the process, you don't even have to pay for your meal or whatever it is that they needed help getting the money for. You paid them to buy your stuff.
I guess because I haven't ever worked behind a cash register, I would not have run into that.
Well, all of this, confidence games, magicians, and so on, are where a lot of the research data comes from for behavioral economics. Why do we make the decisions that we make?
Yes, and that brings me to an article that I had today. But before we get there, I would like to do the thing that we kind of sometimes do and sometimes don't. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, you know, that kind of thing?
Yes.
This is, and we just published our newsletter last night, and I love the news concerning the stock market. The stock market this week did nothing.
It's up 0.25%.
Well, now what?
And the Dow.
The Dow? Oh, I have it up, 0.28, but that's close enough.
Yeah, I have 44.57 points.
Yeah, and the essence, it's easier to talk about percentages, you know. I mean,
so basically nothing happened this week except that some stuff happened.
Yeah, well, the important thing is that the Dow Jones Industrial Average basically didn't rise much of anything this week, 0.28% according to what I'm looking at here.
Friday looked really good.
For 52 weeks, it's down 0.62. Year-to-date, it's up 0.14%. And that's the story. And by the way, last week, when we really didn't talk about what the market had done in the week leading up to Friday of last week, we could have given exactly the same news. Now, this, of course, is the fascinating thing. We had a big dip in between. Yesterday, the market rose like 2 point something. The S&P 500 and Dow both rose over 2% one day yesterday. We had a big dip in August and September and a big rise in October. But the end result is pretty fascinating. And actually, you can extend the end result back 2 years and find pretty much the same thing. Nothing. The stock market has gone nowhere, but you have to give it credit. It's gone nowhere with a great deal of enthusiasm.
Right. Well, look at the five-year return.
Okay.
So we're talking about the Dow. I was looking at the S&P, so I'm going to pull up the Dow.
Mm-hmm.
And we say a five-year return, when nothing has happened in the last 2 years, well, the Dow for the last 5 years is up 56.76%.
That's total.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you had a diversified portfolio, you didn't see that.
No.
No. This is, and if you go back.
And that's not annualized. It's just simple interest from point A to point B.
Right. Anyway. If you go back 10 years, you discover that you really don't have any gains.
Well, if you go back 10 years from today, December 9th, 2005, which is what I'm looking at, the Dow is up 64% between then and now. Now, if you just go back a little bit further, it's pretty flat.
Okay. What I'm trying to say, well, never mind. I guess it's not accurate. It's not true. Go ahead and take it. The point I'm trying to say is that long term. Well, let's put it like this: if you go back to 2000, which is obviously almost 16 years ago. You will find that the rise in the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 is about the same as inflation.
Yeah.
If you go back...
And that's what you're saying. If you put inflation into this...
if you go back to many points in history, in recent history at this point, you're going to see the same story, which is that there just aren't any gains. Now, if you measure from 2009 forward, from the bottom of the market, if you measure from the bottom, if your timing is such that you measure from the bottom of any of these, of any of the downturns, you're going to see some significant rises. But if you measure from the tops, which really weren't all that high, for instance, if you measure, and I'm thinking, I realize that I'm thinking, like, for example, from 2007 to the present, the market has risen, but not very much. And this is the point that I wanted to make at this time. If you look at your portfolio and you see that you have had very anemic increases in your returns, and yeah, you're right, 10 years, we do have a significant gain. But this is the point I want to make here. You said 5 years was what percentage? 50% roughly, right?
The five-year change in the Dow is 56.76%.
And 10 years? 60-something, right?
64%, yes.
Which meant that over the difference between 5 years and 10 years...
wasn't a whole lot. And when you look at the S&P, the five-year return is bigger than the 10-year return.
Yeah, the point is, it's when you measure from a down point, you see these impressive returns. But as you start stretching the measurement out, what you're seeing is essentially a flat market. Right now, if you were to open up Barron's and you look at the last year, you'll discover that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is slightly below. Well, it's very, slightly below where it was a year ago. The S&P 500 is slightly below where it was a year ago. And this is the essence of what I'm trying to tell you, is that seeing a flat return, and that's the perception, at this moment in time is normal. Now, what is that? What the tendency after, particularly if you're one of those persons who's either taking income or taking systematic withdrawals, the point is that you're seeing very, very, very little return. You're taking money out in one form or another, which means you're seeing your portfolio shrink. That's just the reality that I was trying to come across. And measuring from specific dates, you can get a lot of different results.
Yeah, and those dates keep moving because 10 years from tomorrow is different than 10 years from today.
So the point I wanted to make is that there's a tendency at that point to go for a scam. And the biggest legal scam that's going on right now, which is about, last time I looked, right in the vicinity of $500 billion. There's a legal scam going on. It's called hedge funds.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go so far as to say scam, but it's not.
I will.
Okay.
Let me tell you why I'm going to tell you it's a scam. If somebody said, we have a secret method of investing that will make you more money than the common person can find, and we're going to restrict who puts their money in, but... and you need to read the fine print to see this. You can't take any money out without our permission.
Right. And we may not give the permission out of the blue. Most of the time, we'll give you the permission, right, but sometimes we won't.
We're going to charge you 2% on an ongoing basis and 20% of any gains at the time the gains occur. So if the gains occur in the short term, we charge 20%. Now,
but we're not going to give any money back if the market drops.
So this is... or we may give it all back to you after the market drops.
We might just say, here, take all your money and go, but you only have this much money now instead of what you had to begin with.
And we have this secret method of investing where you're going to make tremendous amounts of money. This is the point I wanted to make. According to The Economist, according to Barron's, according to The Wall Street Journal, and there are many different ways of measuring the overall performance of hedge funds, as I found at least 10, and they all gave different answers, but they all seem to agree on something. Over the last 5 years, the typical sophisticated hedge fund has underperformed the S&P 500.
Yep.
Now, think about that just a minute. This is super insider, super secret, smartest guy. As a matter of fact, there's a guy, the S&P 500 12... both year to date and for 12 months is in essence flat. So a guy named Ackman runs a big hedge fund out of New York, and it is one of the more famous and larger hedge funds. He's only down 17% this year.
That's all?
Yeah.
Oh.
And of the last 5 years, he's had 1 year last year when he had a gain. And he did have a little gain of about 6% last year.
Which he took 20% of.
Right. But the other years, the last 5 years, he's had 1 year where there was a gain, and he's down that much this year. I mean, you could add the numbers up.
Here's another piece of that. Let's do a hypothetical, just with the fee structure of a hedge fund. Say you have $1 million. You go to the hedge fund and you say, here's $1 million. And they say, all right, well, we're going to charge you 2% a year plus 20% of gains. And the first year, you drop 30%, or say you drop 17%. So now you're down to $830,000. You're not really happy about this. Well, you have a recovery the next year. And it goes from, and you have a big jump up in say you get a 30% rate of return. Well, you don't really get a 30% rate of return because a big chunk of that goes to the hedge fund manager. So 30% added on minus 20% of the 30%, you start to understand that you're not getting anywhere, that your performance is going backwards even though you're paying for the performance. Yeah, I guess it does kind of hit all the hallmarks of what I would consider a scam.
The issue is that the guys who are running the hedge funds who claim the very, very high returns are not as thoroughly regulated as some other folks. And one of the reasons they're not as thoroughly regulated is they very carefully publish a lot of fine print that you have to sign off on that says what we say may or not be true, may or may not be true. And what you get back may be nothing. And even if you have big gains, you may not be able to claim them. Now, why am I bringing that up? Because one of the things you talked about, Jake, you talked about a minute ago, the fact that a person has to have lots and lots and lots of money to invest in a hedge fund. Except there are privately run accounts, not mutual funds.
Right.
But privately, and even there's a couple of mutual funds that have popped up, and certainly some ETFs, that invest in hedge funds with the big bucks that enable people to put a few hundred dollars into a collection of hedge funds. And this is the point I wanted to make. You start off with an expensive hedge fund. Then you have a fund that charges you money to invest in the hedge to invest in it so that they can invest in the hedge funds. The chances of your making money in something that is in some super secret, we know things that other people don't know hedge fund, drop to nigh on to zero. The chances of you losing money in those accounts goes up very nicely, because one of the things that the ETFs and funds that invest in hedge funds depend on is that there will not be any large-scale liquidations. People will not sell their shares. Because if they do sell their shares, they have to start going to the hedge funds and asking for money. And hedge funds are very notorious for not giving up money when they're asked for. So actually, these funds that invest in hedge funds have in the fine print of their prospectuses, if they have one, that you may or may not be able to get your money out when you go to liquidate. There's no guarantee that we'll be able to do it. And that's just one of those issues that people, I think, are not aware of. Okay?
Cool. All right. I want to talk about oil for a second. Then we've got some commercials to play. This week, OPEC met. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but they met. And OPEC is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Venezuela is a member, and a lot of countries in the Middle East are members. There's a big piece of news, though, in that Iran, which has had sanctions on it for many, many years, the sanctions are being lifted because of the nuclear deal. So they're going to be coming to market to sell about 2 million barrels a day, more than what was sold before. OPEC was trying to convince them to not produce 2 million barrels a day. Because if you look at the production versus consumption, so producing means you're pulling it out of the ground and starting the refining process. Consumption means it's actually being used. worldwide, we're producing about 2 million barrels more than we're using per day, which is filling up all of the storage areas for oil. So that's part of the reason why the prices of oil stay down, is because we have this big boom in the fracking world. We have instability in the Middle East, and in order to afford new defenses and so on, they can't stop pumping oil. Venezuela's having kind of an economic collapse. They cannot stop pumping oil. Russia is having a lot of problems internally, economically. They can't stop pumping oil, even though the price is down. So now Iran coming onto the market with an additional 2 million barrels a day. The president of OPEC, and I cannot pronounce his name, but it looks like the name that would be given to an Ewok. Kachikiwu.
Maybe he
so
is
he's a doctor.
Okay.
So I shouldn't make fun of him, but I can't pronounce his name properly. So he's a doctor, and he said he's the president of OPEC, and he says that OPEC expects the demand for crude oil to in 2016 to increase by 1.2 million barrels a day. What does all this mean? Let me come back to it. We're producing more than we're using by 2 million a day. There's another 2 million a day coming online from Iran, which means that we're going to be producing 4 million barrels a day more than we're using, and demand's going to increase by 1.2 million, which means prices are going to continue to fall. We're going to have more supply than even OPEC thinks that there will be demand to use. Even if Iran wasn't coming into the market, gas prices and oil prices would continue to fall because demand is not increasing as fast as supply. So that's good news for everybody that likes to drive, anybody that likes to fly, anybody that likes to run the AC or the heater. The prices are going to continue to be down for the foreseeable future.
And that probably will go on. And there's a fundamental lesson here. And the fundamental lesson is that most of us older folks remember, and some not so older folks can probably remember something called the theory of peak oil.
Yeah.
That the price of oil was going to shoot up to $1,000 a barrel.
Now, they were talking about this only 3 years ago, that it was imminent.
Yeah, but most people can't remember that far back.
That's a long time ago. That's
old guys.
Old people have to remember for 3 years back.
And so a lot of people invested in oil, and a lot of people have lost a lot of money in oil, and a lot of people are still losing a lot of money in oil. By the way, there was what's called a support level that was much proclaimed, that any time that oil, West Texas Intermediate oil, got to down near $40, buyers would come into the market and they would start buying oil futures and it would go back up again. And it did that for quite a while. Closed out the week at $39 and something, which, big deal, $39, $40, until you get inside the heads of the people who trade oil and they suddenly realize that $40 has no magic power whatsoever.
Right, which means it can drop a lot further.
And there were some analysts from Saudi Arabia who, for whatever reason, and I presume that they knew a little bit about oil, are predicting oil could go to $20. And that's
it's quite possible. We tend to have an overreaction on the downside, just like we have an overreaction on the upside. The good news for the United States is we're net exporters, which means that we are...
Well, it's a good news and it's not so good news.
Why is that a bad news?
Oil's cheap and we're exporting it?
Right. Well, we've had a goal in the United States. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican. There's been a goal in the United States.
Energy independence.
Energy independence.
Right. And we did it.
And we did it. We're here. We now produce more oil than we use. Well, we produce and export net more than is coming into the country.
Yeah,
we're still importing oil, and people ask about that. How is it that we're importing oil if we're net exporters? The answer is that it's not one group of people that's standing, or one person saying, I've got this much oil, and so I'm going to sell it to the rest of the world. There's a lot of companies involved in buying and selling oil, and some of them buy it overseas. Some of them sell it overseas. The net amount, though, is that we are net exporting more than we're importing, which means that we are energy independent. If we stopped importing, it would create some weird situations where some portions of the country would not have oil for a little bit.
We're going to need to break for commercials, but we're going to come back to this just a little bit. One of the reasons our gross domestic product, by the way, which was adjusted upward.
Yes.
One of the reasons our gross domestic product is relatively low is that we are oil exporters.
Yes, and we're exporting at a low price.
Yes, and as a result, we're not making a lot of money there. And it's also one of the reasons, the low price of oil is one of the reasons that the manufacturing index is declined.
Yes.
Which sounds a little strange. We'll be back on the other side with the after these words from the sponsors of Town Square Media. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we were talking about oil just a minute ago. One of the things that's, that has come out in the last couple of weeks, there's a lot of economic news that have come out in the last couple of weeks, is the manufacturer's purchasing index is now below 50. It's 49 point something. Anything below 50 indicates a contraction in manufacturing.
The manufacturers are not buying things to build stuff with.
Right. And that indicates that the manufacturing portion of our economy, which is about 12% of the economy, is shrinking.
Now, when measured in dollars, so how much worth of stuff is being purchased? So it looks like it's shrinking.
Right. And that at a time, there was a time when that would have been very, very worrisome. Frankly, we're clinging to something there that is not at all significant. And let me explain why. First off, we recognize, and it's not a coincidence, that about 12% of our GDP is composed of exports. And we really like the idea that the dollar on Thursday rose to the point where it only took $1 and a nickel to buy a euro. And as recently as a few months ago even, it took $1.34 to buy a euro. So what we have is a rapidly rising dollar, which decreases our export, the value of our exports. Now, that sounds a little crazy. It actually makes them more expensive, but it means that people are less likely to buy from us and more likely to buy from, for example, the Germans, because the euro is, at least according to economists, about 17% below its fair value right now. If we wanted to talk about somebody who is doing currency manipulation, it isn't China. It's the European Central Bank. Because every time they talk about further stimulus and lowering their interest rates, which, by the way, are negative numbers right now, their official European Central Bank interbank loan rates is a negative number. We had ours at zero, and we thought it was too low, but we just weren't innovative enough. They went to a negative number. And the end result is that we look at the Manufacturing Purchasers Index as if that is our economy. Now, here's the reality. We are selling, for instance, if you look at, let me give you a prime example that a lot of people know. The Apple's new iPhone is selling, I don't even know if hotcakes is the right word, but it's selling very quickly.
Yes.
It's selling. People are buying it. It is a manufactured product. But in the United States, our manufacturing index doesn't cover it. Now, why is that? Because Apple, which makes all the profits, is having it manufactured in China.
Right.
Bringing it into the United States and selling it at a significant profit. Profit, which means that Apple's earnings go up, Apple's profits go up, Apple's stock goes up. The company in China's stock is not going up. And the result is that it counts as a service. Now, if you look at the same index only for service, the service purchasing managers
index
is up dramatically. And you think about it, what the heck? What are service people doing purchasing things? And at the same time, Another little tidbit of economic news as we end up the first hour. At the same time, we're seeing wages rise in some interesting areas, and the wage rise is in the service area.
Let me throw this in here, because you're right, but it's also in the manufacturing industry. So manufacturers are paying more in wages, which makes it look like they're making less money.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying less in their purchasing for raw materials, chemicals, metals. All the commodities are having deflation. Their prices are dropping. So in the purchasing index, if you have $100 and you go out and you buy $100 worth of goods, and you're going to use those goods to make stuff, and then the next week you go out and you buy exactly the same amount of goods, but it only costs you $95 because you got good deals, it looks like you're buying less because it's measured in dollars. And that's one of the debates going on here. Are the manufacturing managers, are they actually buying less, or is it just costing less? And that's a question that is interesting because they buy things from overseas as well.
Yeah,
and the dollar is stronger overseas.
It is a purchaser's index.
Right. These people are buying things for less money. They're buying about the same amount. And when you look at the index of actual manufacturing, that's growing.
There's a little key element here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're right at the end of the hour. And I'm going to throw this in here, and it's going to sound just a little bit complicated. But here's the point. Production in the United States, year over year, consumer spending in the United States, which is 70% of our economy, is up 3.9%. Wages up 2.3% over a year ago. And productivity up 2.2%. Now, this is the interesting thing. If you add all those together, and you can, by the way, add all those together, if you see roughly a 4% increase in purchases, which doesn't show up in the GDP yet, then you see that wages are up 2.3%, but productivity is up 2.2%. That means that the people in the United States are actually producing about 4.5% more stuff than they did a year ago, and the consumers are buying it, and the market is flat.
And we're seeing manufacturers hiring more people. We're seeing all the things that we've been waiting for to happen are happening, and the market's flat.
And if the last 2 months hiring new jobs were moved upward, and then we came up with about a $300,000 new jobs this last month in November. In the last 3 months in the United States, we've hired 750,000 people, new jobs in the United States, but unemployment remained at 5%. Why is that? Because people are re-entering the job market. So we had about 750,000 people who were previously not employed, who became employed, but we had the same number of people enter the job market to become employed, so unemployment stayed the same. And by the way, unemployment right now is lower than it was at just about any point during the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing,
it's not quite as low as it was before the recession.
If we say that 70% of our economy, and it is consumer purchases. Consumers are purchasing right at 4% more stuff than they were a year ago. We're producing 4.5% more stuff than we did a year ago. And the market is flat. Now, that tells you something. There's a lag here.
That's why these are called leading indicators.
And the markets will eventually realize it, but we're out of time for the first hour. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to contact us locally, we have voicemail on the weekend, live people during the week, 947-1111, or
1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. If you haven't gotten enough insanity from listening to us live, you may listen to our podcasts and get some more. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.